Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. In addition, I'm going to keep on encouraging everybody to use the power of prayer. And I guess the other thing, welcome back, Tammy. I guess the other thing that, because this is always vexing me, that this has been a struggle, is getting people to realize what the solution really is so that they can recognize that if they're not a part of the solution, they're a part of the problem. And, you know, I could be equally guilty of not going along with anybody else because there's no difference between my way and their way. But we've kind of gone over this just recently when we talked about the different paths, mm-hmm. right? We talked about the convention states, the party, the courts, all of these things that, you know, people are engaging in. And there's just no way we can actually get the federal government back into compliance, because that's the whole point. It's about, I mean, if everybody agrees that the government is doing things that they have no authority to do, how do you stop them? The court will not stop them. As a matter of fact, when you go into the court, we have found that the court has expanded these unconstitutional powers, roles, responsibilities, and so forth. I mean, look at all the different property they possess today outside of those enumerated pieces of property. In other words, military bases, that's about it, or needful buildings. So,
I think yesterday when you brought up Martin Luther and his 95 theses, that was a great example of, because that's how he brought about change. He was like, hey, these are all the problems. This is what they're doing that's not okay.
Right, right. So when we look at the Department of Transportation, we have a petition for that. You're aware of that. How does a convention of states fix that? How does the court system fix that? How does the party fix that? If you take each of these problems through through a model of each of these alleged solutions, you'll realize that there's just no way. The only way to get them to let go of things that they're possessing is by political force, not deadly force, but political force, because you don't have to necessarily kill the individual. You can terminate their career in politics. That's political force. It's kind of like firing the guy. I mean, you know, I remember reading in the New Testament where, you know, there's these advisements. You don't want do not allow the enemy to sleep or live within your home. And so mm-hmm. you have to kick them out. If you realize that somebody you've let into your home is an enemy, you know, undermining you and these other things, you must kick them out, remove them. And mm-hmm. so the process, and I guess maybe people don't get this, that within Article 4 of the Constitution, Section 2, there is, and we kind of covered this, where the states can actually charge their congresspeople with these felonies and or a violate perjury, a felon-based perjury of violating their oath, and bring them back to and replace them, because the governor has the ability to replace all of these politicians. The only way they could, you know, try to not do this. Just remember, as things start happening, it's going to become visible. So when a state basically it comes out and says, we're extraditing these two senators and these three representatives. And I say two because I think there's one Republican state that has, or I should say state that is Republican controlled, conservative, you know, it's a red state. Has actually, I think, two senators representing it. And so, but we could just say one senator and a handful, or, you know, like Texas. I think Texas doesn't have one, but they do have a handful of people in the House. But, you know, in other words, when you see a state saying we're pulling back all of these people who are refusing to actually execute the Constitution or fulfilling their oath of office by executing these directives we just gave them to stand down this unconstitutional vestige, such as the Department of Transportation, because they're not doing it, they're violating their oath.
Right.
As you lay this out in the directive to get sent to Congress, you're basically saying you have no authority. There's no amendment. Here's because they've got the petition. We've already done the petition. This petition proves that you have no authority to exercise this power. Therefore, you have to decommission and dismantle this and turn this back over to the states solely. Only the states can do this. And in this directive, they'll also say that you will need to concede that Congress and the federal government assumed this power and authority outside of the constitutional process, outside of the Article 5 process, and therefore the federal government will never again take on a role, responsibility, or power without the authority being delegated via an amendment. And, mm-hmm. and then the next one will be peeled back, and they'll make the exact same dissertation or the exact same claim that they're not doing this anymore. But if they fail to do it, because we got enough states, in other words, when we get 20, let's just say we have 29 states, because it takes 29 states, not 34, 29. And so, because 34 is what it takes to call a convention.
Mm.
29 is less than that. In other words, it's an easier mark to get to enforce the Constitution. This is just another argument of why the convention is absolutely a waste of time. I mean, to get those last five states could be impossible. But to actually get to 29 states where, you know, you're not even having to – this isn't even a discussion about amending or a convention. So many of the states would just go on board with this. Those states that want to have a convention, that want to come into this, and as a matter of fact, if you read the process, any state that adjoins to the Republic Review process has to basically rescind their request for an Article 5 convention, so that it's very clear that their focus is obtaining compliance before we worry about making any changes to that Constitution. But then, as we look at the 29 states, and we realize that some of these states have some real problems. Texas could be one of them, because Texas is growing in its Democrats. And so even though the people may have elected Democrats, if they refuse to fulfill their oath of office, then the state of Texas and the attorney general of that state has the authority to basically recall them or charge them with perjury for failing to fulfill their oath of office, and then bringing them back. This isn't about treason. This is about perjury, because that's exactly how Senator Howard in the 14th Amendment discussed this. And so mm-hmm. when we're talking about Section 3, when we get to Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. So now we can look at how all of these 29 states will, and this is this is where Democrats will find Jesus. Because when all of a sudden, when Democrats realize that we as a nation, these 29 states have woken up to recognize there is no political compromise to things that are unconstitutional.
Yeah.
You can't just compromise and say we can get away with this. No, you can't. There is a very specific process for you to be able to exercise anything at all, and it must be enumerated, and the only way to get it there is to get three-fourths of us states to say you can do it, period. So as we look at these, I'll just say these states that have all these Democrats, when the Democrats realize that they are going to be removed if they don't do what they're supposed to do, guess what they're going to do? They're creatures of survival. They're going to actually start doing what they have to do. And they're going to try to figure out, unless they're really hardcore evil, you know, like, you know, and absolutely defiant, like John McCain. I mean, we'll see Republicans and Democrats all. It won't be just Democrats, because there are rhinos, there are hardcore communists in the Republican ranks as well. And so all of these folks, because if they, what'll happen is when this directive goes in and Congress says, we're not going to vote on it, because at that point in time, we should have a Republican control, that the whoever is the Speaker of the House is going to probably be coming from a state that's Republican, because they've been in office for a long time. Does that make sense? If you really look at, like, if you look at who is, what is it, Houston, or what's the guy's name? Whoever the Speaker of the House is, I forget. Forgive me, folks. I'm terrible with names. But I know he's from Texas. And, or is he from Louisiana? Either way, it's been a red state for a while. You can't get to that level unless you've actually been a Republican in office for a long time. And usually the blue states, you know, the Republicans don't necessarily, you know, rise up to the top, you know, those coming from a blue state. So my point is I think that whoever the Speaker of the House is, then it's just a matter of having that person pulled down. And as soon as that happens, as soon as that, you know, if there's that level of leadership, the corruption is at that level of the leadership of the party, then though that person will get pulled down. And then everybody's going to get the message real quick. Wow, there's nothing we can do to stop this. These are extradition orders. And the federal government cannot stop a state extraditing a citizen of that state who is being charged with a crime. So this kind of lays this out where we actually have the political force within the Constitution. Now, if the Speaker of the House gets away with basically saying, talk to the hand, I'm going to tell you that that will help convince more states and more people as they do this defiance in public. As we watch this defiance in public, they're going to go, oh my gosh. You know, we got to get rid of these guys. And these are the type, and all of a sudden there'll be a shift in the politics, I'll say, that this shift will actually move towards constitutionalist instead of Republican.
Right.
Right. So anyway, as people start waking up, they'll start going down this path, because I think people will start realizing it's not about conservative. It's not about abortion. It's not about the Department of Transportation. It's about compliance, full compliance. If you don't have it enumerated, you can't do it, period. So, okay. So hopefully people start getting this, because this is what we need. We need to unite on demanding full compliance to the Constitution. You want to solve your problem. This is the center point. This is the high ground. This is where we actually get to this point of clarity, where we actually, you know, have the ability to dictate to our representatives in this Republican form of government that we are not allowing them to politically compromise anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so with that, let's go ahead and move into the 14th Amendment. And actually, I'd like to actually struggle with Section 3 first, because this is really the way. I mean, we covered 4, where 4 actually forced all of the states to come back in. Either you pay your debt or come back in. Because we were not going to reward any nation that was actually trying to undermine the Union, period. So once we recreated the Union and forced that, there's just no way these other states could have afforded to do this. So go ahead and let's start with 3.
No person shall be a senator or representative in Congress or elector of president and vice president or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or under any state, who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States or as a member of any state legislature or as an executive or judicial officer of any state to support the Constitution of the United States, shall have engaged in shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof, but Congress may by a vote of 2/3 of each house remove such disability.
Okay, so it's a mouthful, isn't it? And so what mm-hmm. you're looking at is it kind of creates this list. No person shall be a senator or representative in Congress. And then it expands the list. Or elector of president. In other words, you can't be an elector unless if you violate your oath of office and or that position of being an elector or vice president or hold any office. So when they say or of president and vice president, that is the electors who choose them. It doesn't include the president and the vice president. Why? Because in the Constitution, there's a galvanized process of impeachment, and it's delineated between the House and the Senate and how it's to function. The rest of the cleaning of the House, the purging of the herd, whatever you want to call it, that is done by each House and each institution where we've realized that there's no, you know, there's this, they're den of thieves. I was going to say there's no honor among thieves, but actually there's this den of thieves and this corruption where they all say, well, we're all, nobody gets kicked out. Doesn't matter how bad you are, you're not going to get kicked out. It's almost like when Congress, when Obama went into office, Congress basically said, we will not ever consider impeaching the first black president.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically gave him license to do all sorts of crap. Okay, so it not only basically lays out these political positions, but it says, or hold any office or civil or military under the United States or under any state. In other words, in the militia of a state or a public servant of the state, if you take and raise your arm to the square and you take the oath of office, and if that's what it says, who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States, in other words, you're employed by the United States. It says, so it basically, yeah. If you're employed by the United States, you don't even have to be under an oath. If you are employed or as a member of any state legislature or as an executive. So they're just expanding these first four lines. Four lines going into the fifth line, they are basically setting this, all of these people,
mm-hmm.
you cannot be, you know, a person in service out of all of these different categories of service. And you've taken an oath to support the Constitution. And that's what it says here, having previously taken an oath, then the ... to support the Constitution of the United States, shall have engaged in insurrection. In other words, when they're saying insurrection, it's not taking up arms. It's about defying the Constitution. So does a child, you know, can a child have an insurrection? Can you have an insurrection in your home? When they resist or refuse to do what you tell them to do, that is mutiny. That is an insurrection.
Yeah.
And so all they have to do is fail to do what they're supposed to do or rebellion against the same. The same thing, rebelling or outright doing things that they shouldn't be doing or given aid and comfort, like the illegals coming across and voting for giving them things. Every congressperson that has voted in favor of helping the invaders have violated their oath. And therefore, given aid and comfort to the enemies thereof. When they say enemies, it's not that they're war enemies. They're enemies of our laws. They're enemies against the Constitution. And they have no right to come here and protest and violate and flagrantly violate our laws. So, as we look at what this all says, this means that you cannot maintain yourself in service. In other words, this no person shall be means that as soon as you have been identified for violating, you are to be removed and banned for life. And then it basically says, but Congress may, by a vote of 2/3 of each house, remove such disability. In other words, you can't be and can no longer ever be a public servant until Congress allows you, because, okay, you know, you've made penance and you've done good, and it requires 2/3. That's a that's a significant, it's 66 votes. They can't even get 60 votes anymore in the Senate. And it's the same thing with the House. 2/3 is a huge.
So they could be banned for life, but then they could, if they got a 2/3 vote, they could do it again.
So if they get banned and they come back and that is removed, and if they do it again, then I think that, you know, that's just pushing their, I mean, they have to know by this point in time, just keep in mind that once everybody understands that, you know, all we've got to do is actually just put this little lever on the lock on the gate and the gate will work. As long as you lock the gate, and it doesn't have to be, you know, this big, huge lock. It just, if you look at some of the gates that they have, it's just like this little lever that just jumps up and just goes over this little rail or a little bar or something, boop, and it's locked. And so, you know, it's not a lot of effort. All we have to do is just make sure that that gate stays closed. By using the closing locking mechanism or the, you know, keeping it shut mechanism, it's not a lot of effort. So when people start understanding that it's all about compliance, I mean, heaven help the person that thinks that they can get away with it as this whole tenor and whole paradigm shifts to say, we're watching you now. Heaven help that person that thinks they can get away with it. Once we've crossed this line, once the paradigm has shifted to the point where the people are demanding compliance of the Constitution. The problem is that the people, I hate to say this, that the people that are involved in all of these different efforts, that are involved in the courts, that are involved in the parties, that are involved in the, you know, the convention of states and nullification, they are not centered and demanding full compliance of the Constitution.
Yeah.
That is their problem. Because they say they are, but the only way they can be there is to demand and force and be pursuing in holding them accountable. And the only way we can hold public servants accountable is through petitions. Because that's exactly what a petition does. A petition is, metaphorically, it's like you taking your hand, balling it into a fist, and cocking it back and then swinging it and landing it right between the eyes of a politician. But you're not physically hitting them. You're politically and you're hitting them in their career and in politics. It is a hard blow. And if you do it enough, because you don't have to land a knockout punch. It's about, you know, body blow, body blow, body blow. And next thing you know, they go to their knees because, you know, there's nowhere they can go. We're just beating them up because we're proving that they're allowing all of these things by not standing up and demanding compliance of the Constitution. This is the whole point of these political campaigns, shifting to compliance of the Constitution by creating public relation campaigns. Going into your county commissioners, and you start hitting them with the fact that they're not actually taking a stand and endorsing this petition that stops any involvement in the UN and any international laws coming into the United States because it's all unconstitutional. You have to draw the line and say, stop. You have no authority to do this, federal government. And state, you need to stop them. This all starts at the county. And then the next one is the invasion. You know, everybody, you know, has to be held accountable, and you need to say, we want everybody held accountable. So the county commissioners are going to start realizing that they actually have to take a stand. They are your first line of defense. And so we're going to be going into a break in just a few seconds. But as we look at this PR campaign, it becomes a very ruthless assault. Your politicians are going to see this as a ruthless assault against them. And they're going to go, oh, you know, why hast thou forsaken me? Because thou hast forsaken the law. But anyway, when we come back, we'll dive more into this whole, this process and dive more into Section 3 so that we can kind of come to the conclusion. Then we'll go into Section 2. And then we'll wrap up because Section 1 is probably a lot of meat. Anyway, we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so before we move on, let me just kind of lump all of this together. It says, no person shall be, and then let's just say, any public servant, civil or military, or militia. Okay, and then we go forward with a dot, 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 because it basically says, who have previously taken an oath, dot, 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 in their service. So it'd be dot, 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 in their service would be kind of covering that. And then dot, 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 to, or as a member of, or I'm sorry, having taken their oath to support the Constitution of the United States shall have engaged. So in other words, okay, so you've taken an oath to support the Constitution. Therefore, if you've engaged in an insurrection or rebellion against the same being the Constitution, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof, the enemies of the Constitution, that's it. You mm-hmm. cannot be in office if you have taken an oath at any point in time, and while under that oath, you have engaged in insurrection, rebellion against the Constitution, or given aid and or comfort to the enemy. Now, let me actually expand on this, because the Constitution comes off and says that you're to support this. Now, what the heck does that support mean? That support is something very, very specific that...
I mean, it would be full compliance.
Well, it's very specific, though, because there's different levels of support. So if you're passive, if you're a passive wall, right? So walls can be providing passive support. In other words, it doesn't have to move. It doesn't have to react. It just sits there. And by the fact that it is present, it is supporting the house.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when Madison talks about support, and what I'm looking for, because I want to actually bring this in, and so I'm going to pull the document up because it shouldn't take long for me to find it. And so it is, these are the Virginia resolutions of 1798. And Madison basically talks about what type of support. And in resolution number 3, this is what he says, that this assembly doth explicitly and peremptorily declare that it views the power of the federal government as resulting from the compact to which the states are parties, as limited by the plain sense and intention of the instrument constituting the compact, as no further valid that they are authorized by the grants enumerated in that compact, and that in case of deliberate, palpable, and dangerous exercises of their power, not granted by the said compact, the states or the state legislators, those who are in legislative seats, who are the parties thereto, have the right and are duty bound to interpose. In other words, to arrest, to seize. It's saying that they're not only they have the right to do this, they're obligated to do it. In other words, you can't be passive. If you are in office, this is where we point to that county commissioner. You know, even though it may be their job, it is your job to keep them straight.
Right.
And it's our job to keep you straight. And as long as everybody wants to be passive, then we're going off the cliff. But if we actually start making sure that our local county representatives are actually doing their job, then all of a sudden the crap rolls downhill. When you start holding the people at the top of the pyramid, which are your county representatives, you start holding them accountable, then you'll be surprised how quickly that crap rolls downhill. Folks, I don't think this takes 10 years. I just think we have to be committed. We actually have to put aside our differences and our self-interest. And I'll tell you why there's so few people that want to get involved with interposition, petitioning, and Republic Review. Because there's no money in it. Look at these organizations that have been created because there's money in ineffectiveness. Oh, shoot. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, having worked with contracts in, you know, with the government and having, you know, worked, you know, with contractors as well as being a contractor, you realize very quickly that you make more money based on your inefficiencies.
Yeah.
Even though you can create contracts that reward efficiencies and so forth, you start playing that game of maybe we can be inefficient here because it really wasn't covered in the contract. If we can come back and bleed them for some more money. But that's what happens when you make it about money. And bottom line, what we're talking about people, leaders. I think most of the people that are involved in all of these different institutions from, you know, getting into the courts, you know, because I know that there's efforts like the Flynns, Jack and Margie Flynn out of Maine, they drive this concept of driving affidavits and using the courts and trying to hold people accountable. They're only proving that the court won't work. They're only proving that is so ineffective and inefficient that we're all going to die. And so it's the same thing with all of these different paths. We're all going to die. If we don't start acting as in a literally active process of support, we have to be active, not passive. Because bottom line, when you use the court system, it is a passive process. You're depending on somebody else to actually, you know, engage and arrest the bad players. Why not you exercise your constitutional right there in the Constitution and basically petition them for the redress? Now you are going, so you're bypassing the court, you're directly engaging now. And that to me is a huge difference between what we're doing and what everybody else is doing. And
yeah.
I forgive me if I make people feel bad. It's not my intent because I know you win, you know, you attract more flies with honey than you do with vinegar. And I'm not saying that the patriots of this nation are flies. What I am saying is that it is I have to be brutally honest to help people actually start recognizing that what they are doing is a part of the problem.
Right.
And that lands harsh. You're not helping. If you're out there trying to convince people of the convention of states, you're not helping. So how are we going to move forward? Well, I think the only way we can move forward is by actually trying to create a symbiosis first within these organizations. But, I mean, we've got to get them committed. We need to get the people committed because without the commitment, we're not going to change anything, and we're going to be taken off the cliff. And misery loves company. That's the way I see it. But anyway, so is Section 3, I think we've ran this to ground. This isn't rocket science, but the way they wrote this, I think that this could easily be amended to much clearer and more succinct, you know, like the way I just said it, right? You know, if you are in public service, whether you're a appointee, you're getting a check from government.
And you take an oath.
Well, I wouldn't even just say that. You should be considered obligated to support the Constitution. I mean, you're only as strong as your weakest link. And if you have a bunch of employees that say, well, we're not under oath. And actually, when you really look at the initial Oath Act in 1789, I think it was June or July, when the Congress passed the act of, you know, the administering of the oath. Everybody, I believe everybody that worked for the government that was drawing a compensation was under oath. And I just think if you're receiving a check from the government, then you must support the Constitution. I'll even go one step further. Even as a citizen, you are obligated. Now, I was asked about this by a cohort and a good friend, saying, hey, where do you find the language that says citizens by birth must support the Constitution? Now, when we look at the Tory Acts, as we went through these at the beginning of the year, and you didn't go through them with me, but when you look at the Tory Acts were literally laying out to say, either you support liberty and you support our efforts as the patriots here, or, you know, we're going to arrest you and get rid of you. That was the initial tone. And if I tell people, you need to read this, it's just a few pages, but that set the tone in the very beginning. They were not going to tolerate loyalists to Britain in America if they win. Yeah. And so when it was all done and we won, guess what? 100,000 people, colonists, were basically ripped off of their soil. They lost all their property and they were shipped out. 100,000. Mm. Now, where did they get off with that? They made the law because they basically says, we will not have the enemy among us.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't just Britain couldn't be here. Now, Britain, this is where the hanky-panky of emissaries and people coming in from Britain to, you know, basically be here to visit, because you want to have a friendly nation and an open nation and have open ties even with your enemies. But you want to make sure you guard yourself from your enemies. Well, so Britain, you know, they had emissaries here, but we were not just going to allow people living here that would support them, because they just saw it as an army of 100,000 men or 100,000 people that could easily take up arms, you know, in their midst. Sure. So this idea that every citizen has to support the Constitution, because if you read the oath of a citizen, every citizen must abjure and actually affirm, they have to swear and or affirm that they will support, take up arms to support the Constitution. That's a part of their oath. Huh. Every state in the Union has laws that require their citizens to be compelled to, you know, take up arms. Now, there are, keep in mind, there are conscientious objections. Back in the day, during the ratification debates, if you were a conscientious objector and you were being called to serve, because there's no such thing as the draft. The draft, you know, I know this is kind of big, and I've been told and prodded that, you know, by, you know, my producer friend, what have you, I she's constantly poking me, hey, you need to let people know that the draft is unconstitutional. The federal government has no ability to drive and direct how many people have to be a part of that. That is left to the states. Per the Constitution, the militia is to be managed and operated by the states. They're not to even have this Army and Air Force. That shouldn't even be in existence right there. There is no need for the Army and the Air Force. None. Because we're not fighting a war, nor is there a war here on our soil. The militia and the intended design for the militia was to guard the homeland. The external force, the external military that would take the war to them is the Navy and the Marine Corps. And so when it comes to strategic efforts like ICBMs and intercepting aircraft and long range, you know, bombers and tankers and all the infrastructure to support this warfare outside of the homeland would be the Navy, not the Air Force. The fact that the Air Force exists is an insult to the Constitution. It only proves that the military has been able to aggrandize themselves, and I'm going to get flack on this, and people are going to give me all sorts of hate. But the fact is, the Air Force is just an aggrandized role to allow more men and women that are in service as an officer to attain, you know, general levels and so forth. Because, you know, at the very top, if you have a very lean force, there's only a few generals. But if you have, you know, if you make it big and you bloat it out, there's all sorts of opportunities to be a general. And they always think of new ways to do it because they want to help their pal out, you know, get a really nice retirement and a nice salary. It's about politics. Yeah. When unfortunately, the military has been basically, you know, completely absorbed into the political arena. And the officer corps is about politics.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there are good officers out there, but they're very far and way too few between. So, anyway. All right. Now what we want to do is we want to kind of read Section 2 of the 14th Amendment. Because what has happened is they've now made every person, every Indian that has been living here under the jurisdiction of the federal government, or under the United States, as well as all the slaves, have now been freed and they have now become citizens because of Section 1, and we'll get to that. But here now is this apportionment. This is the only documentation that changes and or touches apportionment, not the ratio of apportionment, but what the apportionment is for. So let's go ahead and read this.
Okay. Representatives shall be apportioned among the several states according to their respective numbers, counting the whole number of persons in each state, excluding Indians not taxed. But when the right to vote at any election for the choice of electors for President and Vice President of the United States, representatives in Congress, the executive and judicial officers of a state, or the members of the legislature thereof, is denied to any of the male inhabitants of such state, being 21 years of age and citizens of the United States, or in any way abridged, except for participation in rebellion or other crime, the basis of representation therein shall be reduced in the proportion which the number of such male citizens shall bear to the whole number of male citizens 21 years of age in such state.
Okay, so that is a mouthful, but the whole intent is that now that these people, these freemen, and now these freemen and Indians, except for Indians not taxed, and see, I think that the Indians not taxed were those that were still independent, and I have a hard time with this because I don't know of very many parcels of land in the continental United States that wasn't a territory. So in other words, the way they did this amendment, I think this one right here is problematic just due to the fact that this was done in a separate bubble by a different group of men in contrast to the first one, I think, because you'd think that they would have actually just basically said, you know, we're making everybody citizens.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be citizens of the United States, which means that they're going to have a right to vote, which means that if you states do not allow any male inhabitant, any male citizen that we've now made citizens, you do not allow them to vote, then we will take that proportion, you know, one for one, away from you in the apportionment, and you will no longer have the full apportionment that we've given you by the census. In other words, if you take 20% of your population and don't afford them the 20% of the males of your population, then you will be we will reduce your apportionment by 20%. So in other words, they will lose one or two or three representatives or even more in the House of Representatives. That's the apportionment.
Mm-hmm.
Because you get, for at this point in time, each 30,000 people are guaranteed one representative. But if the states are going to create laws to inhibit and keep these freedmen and, you know, Indians and so forth, the ability to vote, then you are going to take a hit in your apportionment. Because, see, at the time, you know, the census of 1860, the census may have changed a little bit by population due to the war, you know, death, attrition, you know, births and all of that. It changes a little bit. But in 1866, when they were writing this, they're saying, if you actually reduce, then you stand to lose your apportionment. You'll lose representation. In other words, this was one way to hurt them. And they wanted to make sure that there was a reciprocation if you're going to play these kind of games. But what ended up happening was, and the thing that makes this significant today is this highlighted part that is with yellow, citizens of the United States. In other words, any person that is denied their right to vote, you cannot deny the right to vote to a citizen of the United States.
Right.
In other words, if you give up your citizenship, you do not have a right to vote. Now, you may have a right to vote in the state if you're a citizen of the state and the state makes you a citizen, but the United States government does not allow you to be a citizen. And that happens. If you, we've talked about this with the 1795 Act, or actually an act for the an uniform act of naturalization. It's kind of cumbersome to say. But that act right there basically laid out that the only way a person can become a citizen of the United States is they have to seek citizenship of their state. In other words, you have to move, you take up residency, and then you have to apply to be a citizen. If that state denies that person citizenship because they find out that you're actually of royal descent or what have you, you can't be a citizen. Oh, okay, so they get up and move. And they moved to a different state. Now, one would believe that there had to be a regulation that every time a state denied a person of their citizenship, that information would go to Washington, D.C. to say these people were denied citizenship. So yeah. If they go somewhere else, they can't become a citizen, even if another state says they can. So if they move to another state, become a citizen of that state, and that state doesn't, you know, inhibit them to becoming a citizen because their standards are lower, they didn't do the due diligence for whatever reason. When the federal government gets petitioned to say this person wants to become a citizen, now one would think that everybody's being honest and, you know, not changing their names and that type of thing. But that probably would be what happened if they were going to try to get away with this. But if the state found out, the state that denied them citizenship, they found out that that person actually became a citizen, then they could actually go to the United States and say, hey, we denied that person. They changed their name, what have you, and now you've given them citizenship under a different name. And so the United States would then go and take the citizenship back.
Mm-hmm.
The states controlled that portal. If you weren't going to allow a person to be citizen of your state, they can no longer be a citizen of the United States.
Hmm.
Which means that states can actually start denying people citizenship. They can just make it, you have now become an inhabitant of this state. And you no longer have these rights of due process. You no longer have these rights of, you know, privileges and immunities or what have you. Anyway. But the point is, the key thing here is citizens of the United States. Now, we don't have to go through these, but if we look at, I think it's the 16th, I think it's the 19th, and I think it may be the 24th and the 26th Amendments. There are four amendments that change the process of voting. The First Amendment changes the process of voting that no person of color or race can be denied, you know, because they were actually, after the 14th Amendment, they started creating laws that denied them. And they said, hey, you know, we're going to take the apportionment. And they go, you know, so what? That's going to be minor to us or whatever. For whatever reasons, the states actually, excuse me, southern states still actually, you know, used a thuggery. Now, here's the interesting thing. Johnson, when he was campaigning in 1866 for presidency, said, the South is embracing and loving these brothers, these freemen. We're good people. And yet they started passing laws after the 14th Amendment denying blacks the right to vote. And so they said, okay, if that's the case, then let's just go down to the next amendment real quick. When was it proposed? 1869, ratified in 1870 of the election. Just in time for the purging of the radical Republicans. So they got this in just in time. But if you notice, it says the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Period. In other words, they said, hey, you can't deny people this right to vote for this purpose. The next one was over gender, sex, because mm-hmm. the next one was allowing women to vote. The next one, I think in 24, is the one that basically says you can't have poll taxes. In other words, you can't deny people the access to vote over a poll tax, which was huge, because if you really look at when they did that, I'm going to actually pull that down because we're talking about it. And I'm pretty sure it's the 26th. The right of it is, that's 18 years of age. I think it's 24. Yep, it is. I was right. 62, the right of citizens of the United States to vote in a primary or other election for president or vice president, for electors, president or vice president, or for senators or for representatives, shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state by reason of failure to pay any poll tax or other tax. Did you notice what this didn't include? I'm going to read it again. The right of citizens of the United States to vote in any primary or other election for president or vice president, for electors for president or vice president, or for senator or representatives in Congress shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state by reason of failure to pay any poll tax or other tax. In other words, this one amendment was very specific. You couldn't use a poll tax to deny people to vote in the federal portion of the election.
Mm-hmm.
Did it say anything that they couldn't deny people to vote in the state by using a poll tax?
Mm-mm.
So now you've got it. Now you understand that you can actually start eliminating by actually having property tax. If you pay property tax, that is your poll tax to vote. If you don't pay, we'll dive into this in the next episode. But I just wanted to, I'm pulling this in because this is huge. Anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.